The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to Inside Medical Nutrition Podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Linya Patel. In today's episode, I'm talking to a dietitian who works in research, Dr. Michelle Harvey, who is the principal research dietitian at Manchester Foundation Trust. Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation because we're both dietitians and you are also leading researchers. So you're a real inspiration in the nutrition research world. So I'm just really looking forward to learning more about what you do. So let's start off. And to kick off, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? Where are you based at the moment and what's your current role?
So thanks for inviting me. It's a great privilege to talk about our research, and it's nice that someone's interested because sometimes it doesn't always feel like that, but we'll come on to that in a bit. So I'm a research dietitian. I'm quite lucky or unusual in that all of my role is doing research into diet. And I've been doing research full-time for about 21 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, you know, a very varied role. It's actually, I'm based in Manchester at Withenshaw Hospital.
Okay.
Which is now part of Manchester University Foundation Trust.
Okay.
And I'm based in a building called the Nightingale Centre, which is, and the Breast Cancer Prevention Centre. So most of my work, up until I did the MIDAS study, which we're going to talk about in a bit, has been around whether we can use diet and weight loss to help reduce women's risk of breast cancer and also help them to manage breast cancer if they're going through treatment. So most of my research over the last 20 years has been based in the breast cancer unit there. And so it's, you know, it's quite a unique role to be doing 100%.
It sounds like a fascinating role and you're doing such important stuff. So what made you go into research?
My first degree was actually biochemistry.
Okay.
Which I did in Manchester in the late 80s. And that was, you know, very interesting, but it was very lab-based and I realised I wanted to do something with people. So then I did a postgraduate and in Leeds and became a dietitian back in the early 90s, if anybody remembers that, possibly not that many on this call. And I did a postgraduate in Leeds. And then I was lucky enough to get a really nice varied basic grade role at Manchester Royal Infirmary, which is actually the trust I'm still at, funnily enough, I'm on a different site. And I worked as a dietitian, a clinical dietitian for 4 years. And I actually, within 2 years, I became a band seven. Those were in the days when you could become a band seven because you were just a sort of specialist dietitian covering gastro and intensive care. And all the way along that and all the way through my dietetic training, I've always been, you know, fascinated by how we can, obviously, as dietitians hopefully are, how we can change people's diets to improve their health. But I realised a lot of the things we were advising, a lot of the questions were coming up, weren't really that well researched.
Mm.
And so there's a massive gap in. So we were doing quite often advising things that were not necessarily that well couched in good evidence, which was a problem to me. But also I realized that, you know, there is so much misinformation out there.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to, there was a PhD that was advertised back in 95, which was looking at diet and cancer, and I applied and I got it, and I've never looked back.
Wow. And so, I mean, I'm curious to find out, what does a day in the life of a research dietitian look like?
Okay, so it's varied.
Yeah.
It can be very long. It's often very long because it's very open-ended. So so there can be some days where, because I'm now quite senior and I lead a team, so I guess I've got some sort of, you know, supervision, managerial responsibilities, which comes with most roles, doesn't it, these days. I also always make a point of when we're when we're running clinical research trials, we do work with people. So we're doing, you know, research studies which involve asking people to try different diets and then see whether they can do them and see what happens. So I always make a point that I don't personally see all the patients in a trial, but I always make a point that I have a small number of the patients myself, just so I don't lose touch.
Okay, so you're still clinically
exactly. So okay, my clinical practice is always within.
So important in research, I think.
Oh my goodness.
It gives you that added insight that I feel sometimes within academia, if it's just academic, misses.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And so you get the ideas of what where the problems are, but then you also realize that perhaps the fantastic diet or behavioral intervention you thought was going to be really whizzy and solve everyone's problems perhaps doesn't quite work as well, particularly when you get that firsthand feedback from patients. So I always have a role with patients. In fact, after the thing today, I'm going to be doing some calls with some of the ladies who are in one of our low calorie diet studies. And then there's a lot of time where I can spend, trying to get grant funding. So we're obviously reading lots of literature, trying to develop a research proposal and writing protocols, writing research up, doing analysis, doing stats, going to present at conferences.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a huge amount of that. There's a lot of, like with most roles these days, there's a lot more bureaucracy and things now. So there's a lot of paperwork we need to fill in.
If you're running studies that involve human patients.
Well,
when I was reading about some of the publications that you've done, I see you're famous for the two-day diet. What can you tell us a little bit more about that?
My sort of first research was looking at how we might reduce women's risk of breast cancer, and back in 2005, actually, we were one of the first groups to show that if a woman could lose even just 5% of her weight or more, then that would severely reduce her risk of breast cancer. Because we know that, sorry, I should have said that weight, being overweight and gaining weight increases risk. And then, so the advice up to that point was people shouldn't gain weight as they go through adult life, which I thought, well, that's good advice, of course, but how does that help, you know, the 60% of women who are already overweight, who, you know,
and it's hard.
Is it reversible? Is there something they can do? So anyway, we did a big piece of work with some researchers in America, which was the women were in this something called the Iowa Women's Health Study. We were able to show that we had measurements of their weight over years and whether they'd gone up or down and whether they got breast cancer. So we were able to show from that piece of work that we published in 2005 that if women could lose 5% of their weight, it would reduce their breast cancer by anything between 25 and 40%, at which point my boss, my supervisor, who is a professor of medical oncology, was running, dancing around the office. That's kind of how he is. Going, this is fantastic, Michelle, you've cracked it. And I said, hang on a minute. Can I just stop you there? It's good that we know what we're aiming to do, but actually trying to get people to lose weight is really hard. And trying to get a maintained weight loss of even 5%, which when you think about it, actually isn't very much, is it? It's five kilos if you weigh 100 kilos. And so I said, I think we need to think about how we might make dieting more easy for people to do, more effective. Anyway, so at the same time, so the idea was whether, you know, there was some interesting work in lab rats, not that we'd done, but that I was able to read about, where it looked like if you calorie restricted a mouse for small periods in the week, just 1 or 2 days, rather than over the whole week, then you would actually be reducing their risk of cancer more than if you did a daily restriction. And then I thought, well, it might be easier for people to do. So we developed the two-day diet in 2006. And I think the rest is kind of history.
It's incredible. And I work in obesity as well. And the idea of telling people actually for 2 days is where you're going to have to, I mean, it's not about feast and famine, but it's still trying to eat more healthily on the other days, but actually only really creating that big calorie deficit on the 2 days feels so much more manageable for so many people.
Yeah. It's not for everybody, but I think it's another great tool in the toolbox. It's not a panacea, it's not universally better than everything else, but it's just another tool, and it really can work.
And when you say it's not for everybody, who is it not for?
So at the moment, I mean, we can talk about this, so we're actually doing some work seeing whether the two-day diet could actually help women who have got gestational diabetes during pregnancy, which is quite a step forward, because obviously that trial is hopefully going to start in a few months' time. And we're really pleased we've got money from the NIHR to do this feasibility study, which is looking at really whether pregnant women can do it, with pregnant women with gestational diabetes can do the diet, and also whether it's safe, because of course there are concerns about ketones and etc. You know, in pregnant women. So we're doing that. So at the moment, you know, we wouldn't advocate the diet for.
Yeah.
People, I guess, with a history of eating disorders or with current eating disorders, it's probably not a good idea. Although interestingly, most research that's been done in sort of intermittent diets actually shows that, you know, of course, when people lose weight, they tend to have less issues with eating disorders. So I don't think there's no evidence that these diets trigger those behaviors, but I guess if somebody's got that problem, then it's probably not a good idea. Again, there's been some work with adolescents, which we've not done, but again, that probably needs supervision. But that again has proven to be, you know, adolescents with obesity. So that's proven to be safe. I guess you would, you know, at the moment, the diet is very much a tool for weight loss. And there are certain groups who are on certain medications. It's even been used in renal patients, I think. But of course, with all these things, and we're doing some work in type 1 diabetes, that you need to manage the patients with their clinical team, with the medicines and stuff. So it's not a thing that people can just run away and do.
Absolutely. We've touched on type 2 diabetes. You talked about gestational diabetes. And I recently read a publication that you did, and I hope I'm saying it right, the MIDAS study.
Yeah,
the
MIDAS.
You can tell me what it actually stands for. And that was looking at weight loss in type 2 diabetic patients. And I know one group was given a very low calorie restricted diet, and the other was doing the 5-2 or the 2-day diet.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about this research.
So the MIDAS study, or the MIDAS study, now let me see if I can remember what the acronym stands for. Manchester Intermittent Diabetes Diet App Study.
Because it was linked to, okay, fantastic. So
that's a very big mouthful. So what on earth was it about? So we actually started the study in 2018, and we were really pleased. We got funding from Nestle Health Sciences and Aviva. At the time, we were very aware of all the really, really motivating and interesting work that's come out of things like the DIRECT study and the droplet study. Diabetes, you know, with low calorie diets. And low calorie diets is, you know, you take someone away from their normal food, you ask them to follow typically a formula-based diet for anything between 12 and 20 weeks, you know, 850 calories, they lose, you know, lots of weight. And the DIRECT study, 50% of patients were losing 10% of their weight out to a year. And, you know, about half of them were going into diabetes remission. So this is great. And of course, because of these really compelling results, these diets are being rolled out in the NHS. There's a low-calorie diet pilot program going on across the country, and that's all fantastic. But we, you know, like all these things, we sort of wondered, well, is there a bit like the 5-2 diet, is there another way of, you know, because that diet is going to work for some people, but not everyone's going to be able to do it or want to do it, you know, from a just a lifestyle point of view. So we wondered if there was a different way of doing it, not necessarily that would be better, but just might have a bigger reach. Because actually, if you look at the DIRECT study, you know, only about 20% of people agreed to join the study. So that's a lot of people who didn't want to do it. And actually, if you look at the low calorie diet pilot study, it looks like, you know, the conversion rate from people being asked to joining the diet is certainly way less than 50%. So there's a lot of people that it's quite overwhelming, right? A low calorie diet. So we wondered if again we could do the intermittent thing. So rather than doing, in our case, we had 8 weeks of very low calorie diet. Low calorie diet. They were asked to do 2 days of the Optifast a week for 28 weeks. So it's the same number of low calorie days,
okay,
just spread over a longer period. And so we wanted, and then we followed them up, both groups up to a year. And we published it, as you say, earlier this year. The final study finished just before the pandemic. So we were able to get the final patients through and the measurements done. So this is kind of pre-pandemic. And they were remotely supported by the dietitians, gave individual support to the patients using the Aviva app. No, it's great. So at the end of the study, we were able to show that the intermittent and the continuous version of a low-calorie diet actually were very similar in terms of weight loss.
Okay.
But there seems to be maybe a suggestion, but it's quite small numbers, so we can't overstate it. But it may be that the continuous is maybe better at putting people into remission. And so we're doing some work now trying to see how we can make the intermittent diet perhaps a bit more effective.
Yeah. And maybe more of how you use it in the long term as well, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. I mean, this is it. Both groups, you know, so by the time we got to the end of the eight weeks of low calorie diet and 4 weeks of food reduction. By the time we got to 12 weeks in the continuous daily diet group, that was their lowest weight loss. They lost about 10%, whereas the intermittent dieters got to their lowest weight at 28 weeks. But both groups then regained some weight, which is the way it goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. So I guess what's on your next, what's on your list in terms of the next research projects that you've got up your sleeve?
Yeah. So building on the MIDAS, which was, you know, a very, very interesting study. So I say that's highlighted that intermittent diets are certainly safe. People can do them. But one of the problems is that they just can't, like most things, people can do it for about 6 months, but then in the last 6 months of the study, they were only doing about a quarter of their low calorie days. So there's a real, so we want to do some more work on how we can maintain people on low calorie diets.
Massive.
And weight loss,
yeah,
maintenance, massive
long-term
issue. And in terms of diabetes remission, we're planning to do some research trying to make the intermittent diet, the 5-2 diet, you know, more effective, and hoping to sort of match some of the results that you'll get with you know, like the direct study, the daily diet. I've already mentioned the gestational diabetes work, and we've got a study in type 1 diabetes. One. So those are the main things. We're very interested in, yeah, finding alternative. Not there's anything wrong with the standard low calorie diet rollout program. That's going to work for a certain proportion of the population, but we're trying to find alternative ways.
Yeah, and I love that, Michelle. And I think what stands out is because you're a clinician, you've got that practical dietitian hat on at the same time, right? So you're asking the questions as a researcher, but you're also thinking, hold on, how are people actually going to implement this in real life?
Yes.
And I know a lot of the listeners listening to this podcast, there might be some dietitians, NHS dietitians or other dietitians who are working in the field of type 2 diabetes.
Yes.
So, I mean, practically, is offering a low calorie restricted diet or the 5-2 diet going to work for everybody? And what would your words of advice be to somebody who's working in type 2 diabetes in terms of what to offer their patients?
Yeah, so I think either approach could be used. I mean, although our MIDAS study was published this year, it is a feasibility study. So we've not, when you do research, you realize that you have an idea for a research question, you need to do a sort of smaller study to show the feasibility. So it's not definitive proof that would be enough to put it in NICE guidance, for example.
Yeah.
And that will require a bigger study, which is, I guess, where we're going next, or trying to go next, because we'll have to apply for funding. So that would be, to be honest, by the time we've applied for funding, done that research, you're probably talking about another, you know, 6-7 years before that has the level of evidence that you'd require for NICE guidance. But anyway, in the meantime, yes, so we certainly know that the standard low, you know, daily low calorie diets that are being used in the low calorie diet rollout, they really do work for a lot of people. And I think there is a lot of, although the evidence is there, I think there's a lot of concern amongst some dietitians that it seems a bit drastic. People have this concern that if people lose weight quickly, it's not good. and that they're going to put it all back on again. And that's really not the case. In fact, it's the reverse. Often if people lose a lot of weight quickly with these low calorie diets, with proper supervision, obviously from a dietitian, they generally maintain their weight loss better than people who do the slower approach.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe that motivation as well.
I think so.
And then it's just looking at then the support, so it kind of stays off and the long-term of it.
Yeah. That's right. You need ongoing support. So if you just support people through the low-calorie diet period, that's a problem. So they need, you know, and the low-calorie diet program is around supporting them through the low calorie diet bit, which is almost the easiest bit, to be honest. And then it's the maintenance, getting them back onto food, and the maintenance phase that where they really need the support. But people could try the intermittent diet. But I think there's a lot of, and I can understand it. I think we're all dietitians, very interested in food, and we want people on healthy diets. And we have this sort of concern about putting people on formulas. But I think sometimes people just need to get away from food.
Yeah.
And you know, the evidence shows that generally formula diets versus food-based do tend to be more effect, obviously long term.
Oh, that's interesting, because I mean, what are your thoughts about the importance of gut health, particularly in the long term?
Yeah.
So I guess if it's food and my mind as a dietitian, then you're going to get more phytonutrients in terms of gut health and the importance of that.
Yes.
Perhaps that's a benefit. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a really good
maybe
point.
You need to do more research on that.
No, and actually that is an issue with the formula. So when we do low calorie diets with the 850 diets, what we actually do is we do three of the formula products, and then we actually have them having about 8 portions of vegetables.
Oh, great.
So they're getting non-starchy vegetables. We do, okay. Yeah. So a lot of people just do four lots of formula diet, don't they, to get their 850. But we, a quarter of their calories, they get from non-starchy. And that's really good, because it really gets them in the groove of having vegetables, and that just persists. We haven't actually looked at the gut microbiome, but that is one of my concerns with formula diets. Absolutely.
Yeah. And definitely an area where we need more research anyway to see the role and the importance and how we can optimize that, particularly for type 2 diabetes, because we know that their gut microbiome is slightly different anyway. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
So lots of research projects for you to get involved in, Michelle.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me, what is your favorite part of the job?
That's a tricky question. So I could probably tell you what my least favorite.
Maybe tell me what the challenges are as well.
No, well, I will. Okay, let's come on to the favorites. Do you know? So we've obviously just had two. Well, are we come out of the pandemic? I'm not quite sure. But anyway, we've had 2 years where I've been doing what I'm doing to you, just sitting on my computer and talking to people remotely. And actually, I was presenting at a conference in Newcastle a couple of weeks ago with a lot of my peers. So talking about research, which is why this is such a delight this morning, talking about our research, talking to like-minded people, people who are interested, talking to other researchers, bouncing off ideas, you know, seeing the results out there. That's fantastic. And that was such a buzz. I came back from that really, really motivated. And also working with patients in trials. And I guess most dietitians perhaps won't have had that privilege and that, you know, that experience. But, you know, quite often in dietetics, you've got, you know, a very limited period of time. You might see somebody once, you give them advice, they go off, no idea what happens. And in research, depending on the type of research, but generally in our research, we give advice, we follow them up, we get to see all the, you know, sometimes following up, sometimes it's particularly weight loss isn't such a good idea, but you get to see what happens to their blood results, you get to see a whole and their psychological profile. So you really get to know patients, like, you know, personally and, you know, biologically as well. And that's really interesting. And then you put all that data together and then you get your findings. So that's great. I guess the thing with, what is challenging about research is it is hard. Yeah. You know, you get a lot of, sometimes everybody thinks your ideas, sometimes people think your ideas are great, but quite often you get a lot of knockbacks. You'll write a really nice grant application, you'll send it off and it will get rejected. And grant applications can take, you know, 6 months to put together. Yeah. And then, you know, a year, you know, you have to wait a year for the result, and then you get a knockback. You know, you can write a paper for a journal and it can get rejected or criticized. There's a lot of criticism you have to take. And quite often you take criticism but you don't have a chance to respond to it, so that's quite frustrating. And there's a lot of I think just the like everything's become way more bureaucratic. So there's an awful lot of paperwork and stuff we need to.
Fantastic insight, thank you. And we're going to wrap up, and before we wrap up, I would love it if you could give some helpful hints for any of our listeners, dietitians and maybe student dietitians who are wanting to go into research. What would your top tips be for them?
Do it. It's a great thing to do. Now there's lots of, you know, there's much more interest in clinical academics. And so there are lots of really great schemes. If you look on the, you know, the BDA has information about this, the NIHR has information about different funding streams for dietitians to do, and particularly like split posts that are clinical and academic. So that's really great. And there are lots of opportunities to do sort of like, there's pre-doc programs, and then you're building up, there's some master's programs building up to sort of do PhDs. So that's really great. Dietitians need, good dietetic research needs to be within a multidisciplinary team. So dietitians, depending on what it is, but I would say on the whole, my ability to do research has been because I've been in two fantastic teams. Firstly, the oncology team. So I work with oncologists, I work with geneticists, I work with the nurses, I work with pharmacists, and now, you know, the diabetes team. So you have to be part of a multidisciplinary team, and you can all learn from each other. So I think that's really, really important. And it's just fascinating, and you've no idea what's going to come.
Definitely. And we definitely need more dietitian and clinicians in research. That's definitely for sure. Yes. Michelle, thank you so much for your time. I knew it was going to be a fantastic conversation, and absolutely was. So thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues. And consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.